afternoon. The Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order. Thank you all that are attending here in person in this room, and thank you to all who are attending in the overflow room. And I also know that we have many people that are listening in online today. We do have a lot going on in this committee during the February session, and as a result, we really have to stick to our schedule moving through. The order in which we are taking up bills today, first we will do an organizational meeting. We will then move to Senate Bill 1582, then to Senate Bill 1575, then to Senate Bill 1533, and then to Senate Bill 1548. We need to clear this room by 2:50. And as a result, I'd like you to make sure that you are able to hold your comments to about 2 minutes if you're able to, so we can accommodate as many people as we possibly can. If we do not get through everybody that has signed up today, never fear. We have all of these bills reposted again for next Monday. We are not moving these bills today, but we do know that this is a session that is very much about housing, that we will all have many rich and lively and exciting conversations about these issues in the days ahead. So thank you so much. What is this? Oh, great. Thank you. There's suddenly a computer looking at me. Okay. So we need to start with the organizational meeting. So I'll open up the organizational meeting for the adoption of committee rules.
Are you waiting for me to say
something? I'm waiting
for
you, Senator Olson. Do we have a script for Senator Olson?
I did not prepare a motion script, Madam Chair.
You did not.
What are we moving on?
Move approval of
moving for adoption of rules.
Yes. Do we have the rules?
They've been posted online for more than a week on OLIS, the proposed committee rules. If the committee would like a summary, I can give that.
Could you give a summary, please? Thank you.
The interim rules are adjusted to account for the short session, and they are based on chamber rules, of course. On the Senate side, there are no significant changes from the last set of interim rules, which included one new rule at the time, and that was that amendments and measures must be public at least 1 hour before a committee may act on them. And the remaining rules are the same. If the committee has any questions about filing minority reports in the short session or anything like that, there's no deviation from the previous session.
Questions?
No, I don't have questions.
Motion?
Motion. Madam Chair, I move to approve the rules for the Human Services and Early Childhood Committee.
Senator Olson moves approval of the rules for the Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objection? Seeing none. So ordered. And while we're in the organizational meeting, there's one other piece of information that we need to take up. There is so this will make sense when I get through my script here. But Oregon's legislature is one of the most open and inclusive in the nation. We hold public hearings on each of our bills and seek input from the public in our committee process. We depend on the information provided to us by the citizens of Oregon. No one can tell us better how laws we pass affect the people of our state than the people that come and talk to us in the committee, whether they are members of the general public or people that are working for an agency or a public office. In return, the expectation is respect for the members of the committee, respect for the legislative process, and of course that the information that is provided is truthful. And I always assume that that is when people come before the committee. Whether you are another member of the Legislative Assembly, the director of an agency, a lobbyist, or a member of the general public, we expect for your testimony to be truthful. Under the statutes of the state of Oregon, the chair or the vice chair of a committee has the ability to ask any witness before a committee to be sworn, to take an oath, to swear to tell the truth under penalty of perjury, and that right belongs to the chair or the vice chair. And the vice chair of the committee has informed me that he may exercise that right over the course of this session, and it is within his rights to do so. So should that happen in this hearing or any other hearing, the rights that you have in that circumstance are to not swear an oath or affirm an oath. You can walk away and not testify if you choose. You can choose to have an attorney present with you. You can avail yourself of your Fifth Amendment rights, including the right not to give testimony against yourself. And if you tell the truth, nothing you say in this committee whether you have sworn an oath or not, can be used against you in any state proceeding. You should know, however, that this immunity does not extend to any federal legal proceeding that may be brought against you, including a federal criminal proceeding. So as part of the organizational meeting, just wanted that to be clear in the meetings that we have moving forward, that those are the rights to ask for it and the rights that you have in return if you are asked to swear or affirm an oath. And yes. I'm sorry, what are we doing now? Can I finish this first?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. So anything further on this before we move on to the hearing? All right, thank you. With that, I'm going to close the organizational meeting and open up a public hearing on informational meeting on Senate Bill 1582.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1582 creates a fast-track housing program to be developed and implemented by the Oregon Housing and Community Services and Oregon Housing Stability Council to increase state-owned affordable housing that may be purchased or rented by low-income individuals and families. It authorizes general fund appropriations, specifies program parameters and considerations, sets limits on the state's legal interests in real property, requires department to report regularly to the council and by February 1st, 2017, for three consecutive years to the legislature, declares an emergency is effective on passage.
And were you telling me with this note that Senator Farrioli wants to testify right now?
I was mentioning that he's in the room.
Do you want to come now? We have you last on the agenda. Are you able to come back when we open your bill, or do you want to offer your testimony now?
It's your pleasure.
If you would be willing to come back, that would be really helpful. But I will absolutely accommodate you if you can. Okay, thank you. All right.
And there is a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Thank you. All right, we have Danny Ledesma, Jacob Fox, and Margaret Van Vliet. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelster, Vice Chair Olson. My name is Danny Ledesma, for the record, and I serve as Governor Brown's Housing and Human Services Policy Advisor. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 1582, which authorizes Oregon Housing and Community Services to implement the Local Innovation and Fast-Tracked Housing, or LIFT, as it's called, housing program. Senate Bill 1582 is the governor's priority bill to provide guidance and direction to OHCS for the LIFT program. In 2015, Governor Brown championed a request for Article 11 Q bonds to develop new affordable homes for families. And the legislature committed and allocated $40 million in bonding for this purpose. This bill is Governor Brown's priority for several reasons. Primarily because to succeed, you need a home. Children need a stable home to achieve their potential in school. Parents need an affordable home to support their employment. And we all need a safe home to improve our health. Throughout Oregon, hardworking families are struggling to find and maintain the stabilizing anchor that housing provides because rents are increasing faster than wages, vacancy rates are at historic lows, and more people are experiencing homelessness. Last year, over 21,000 children in the K through 12 grades were reported as homeless. This is a 12% increase from the year before. One in three Oregonians pay more than 50% of their income on rent. One in two Oregonians pay more than 30% of their income on rent. To afford the average fair market rent for a two-bedroom apartment in Oregon, you need to earn at least $16.81 an hour, or you could work 70 hours a week to be able to afford at the current minimum wage. From OHCS's Moving from Poverty to Prosperity report, we know that over 16% of Oregonians are living in poverty. Of Oregon's 36 counties, half, or 13, have populations lower than 25,000 people. Of those 13 counties, eight have a higher poverty rate than the state average. From the same report, we also know that people of color experience poverty at much higher rates. Over 30% of African Americans, that's more than double, experience poverty. Over 32%, which is double, of Pacific Islanders live in poverty, and nearly 28% of both Native Americans and Latinos live in poverty. Children are also disproportionately impacted by poverty. Children under 18 make up 22% of the state's population and make up 30% of those living in poverty. Of the total people receiving TANF benefits administered by DHS in December of 2015, 68% were children. Last year, DHS also reported that on any given day, over 7,500 children were in substitute care in the child welfare program. So what this means in Lane County, for example, is that on any given day, there are over 1,058 kids in care. This is the second highest rate in the state. 49 young adults left foster care without a permanent family after turning 18. But in Lane County, last year, an innovative partnership between NEDCO and Looking Glass Independent Living Program, they were able to build 14 new units of housing for foster youth aging out of the foster system. And these units were renovated and made available to the Looking Glass participants. This is a great first step. However, Looking Glass currently serves over 90 young adults and has a waiting list of around the same size. For those who are not living in these units, they would have to earn over $55,000 a year to afford a two-bedroom fair market rent apartment in Lane County. These figures are daunting, yet we know that children and families, no matter where they live, deserve an anchor. We know how to address this issue. We need to increase our supply of safe, affordable, and decent homes for Oregonians. Among incredible market pressures and increased need, we are fortunate that through your leadership, the legislature allocated funding to help increase our supply. And yet, despite this historic investment in Oregon, we need more tools to help local communities develop more affordable units and to protect vulnerable tenants living amongst these turbulent housing markets. Without other tools, we will need to focus and prioritize the LIFT program. In August, the governor directed OHCS to focus on serving rural communities with populations under 25,000, to focus on developing housing to serve communities of color, and to work closely with the Department of Human Services to serve clients in their child welfare and self-sufficiency systems. We want to applaud both the department under Margaret Van Vliet's leadership, as well as the two subcommittees who have taken up this direction and are working to advise the director, Margaret Van Vliet, the Housing Stability Council, and the legislature about their best recommendations for implementation of this program. As the department has hit the ground running, literally running, in working to implement LIFT, they will need additional staffing to program and administer this new program to ensure its success. We will also be bringing forward amendments to this bill to address ownership and operating models with Article 11Q bond requirements and recommendations by the two LIFT committees. And both Margaret and Jacob will provide you with more details about this. Thank you.
Thank you. And just as a time check, we have about 12 minutes left for this item, inclusive of Q&A and the other two people that are signed up. So.
Chair Gessler, my name is Jacob Fox, and I'll be as brief as I can. I'm the Executive Director for the Housing and Community Services Agency of Lane County. We're the second largest housing authority in the state of Oregon. And I can tell you clearly that this has been a really good process, and we know that communities like Oak Ridge and Cottage Grove in Lane County will benefit from the LIFT program. We are seeing extreme needs for affordable housing across Lane County, and in 2015, the legislature delivered for Lane County with the $40 million of LIFT. We, across Oregon and in Lane County, what we're seeing is low-income folks are facing very low vacancy rates and rising rents. I'll give you an example from our Section 8 program. In 2014, it took an average Section 8 participant about 2 months to find a place to live. In 2015, that went to 2.5 months. So we are seeing dramatic market changes in Lane County, and I know those are happening across the state. So last summer, as Danny mentioned, there were professionals from throughout the state of Oregon that came to the table. Folks from housing authorities, nonprofits, and the private sector came together and really met over the course of the summer and the fall to build some program recommendations for the legislature and for Margaret as the leader of HCS. After several months of working together, the subcommittees have made recommendations to the Housing Stability Council about how to design this program, and I'll touch on a couple of the high points there. Obviously, we support the priority population focus that the governor and HCS have prioritized. We believe that the focus should be on developing new units as opposed to fixing up existing units. We've encouraged HCS to do outreach and bring organizations and individuals to the table that might not always be part of affordable housing development. I think that's where the private sector, the United Way, and organizations from Lane County like Central Latino are critical in delivering. We are making recommendations to HCS to make sure that the constitutional requirements are met by OHCS, and we believe we have a recommendation that will meet these requirements. And we've also made recommendations about just the areas of need across the state, and in particular communities within our cities and counties that need the extra help. So with that, I want to just give my wholehearted endorsement and let you know that private sector and the public sector and the nonprofit leaders in Lane County are excited to implement this program.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, my name is Margaret Van Vliet. I am the director of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. Thank you very much for hearing this bill today. We are pleased that this is, of course, a priority of the governor. And I want to try and answer questions you may have about the process and share with you the context for these amendments that are sort of that are still pending, and I understand being worked on actively in the next few days. Last session, you'll recall, the department worked with the legislature to develop House Bill 2198. That bill would have given the agency sideboards or guidelines for the $40 million in general obligation bonds to develop the new housing. As Danny stated, the legislature did commit the bonds, but due to deadlines, House Bill 2198 did not end up passing. So today we are back with Senate Bill 1582. Now, the intent of the bill, as you've heard, is to provide guidance about how we will meet the ownership or operational requirements of these Article 11Q bonds. And since this is a new source of money for affordable housing, it is taking some time to be certain of the parameters surrounding the role that the state must play in owning or operating the assets that get financed using this source. The amendments that we're working on reflect the work done on this front since July to understand the requirements, as well as the work you heard Jacob describe of the subcommittees advising us. In short, the amendments will give the department the authority to either own or operate the housing consistent with the constitutional requirements. And from a real estate finance perspective, there are different ways to meet the requirements, and there are different risks associated with the various alternatives. In, quote, owning or operating the property, the intention is that the state have some measure of control over how it gets managed, who lives there, and so forth. But we don't want to become an active landlord, so we will instead have contracts and partnership agreements that let us lean on private sector experts while still retaining the constitutionally required role. There will be some important differences from what we do today when we help finance a property, so we'll continue to seek advice of both legislative counsel and the Department of Justice while, again, leaning on private sector real estate actors so that we can carve a path that works in the real world. The amendments also give additional oversight to the Housing Stability Council to determine how to measure need and identify priority communities and to oversee the development and implementation of the basic program. You'll notice that the bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. The agency will need additional general fund and position authority to hire staff to successfully implement the program and monitor properties over time, again, with this new role in mind. Quick note about our Housing Stability Council. Last session, the legislature passed House Bill 2442, which did give additional oversight responsibility to this council. Members are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, and we're excited by their new role and the advice they're already giving us in that capacity. I do want to thank Jacob and other members of the committee, and of course Danny and the governor, for their dedication and input throughout this process. We have received and taken to heart the critical and valuable feedback from the legislature and from the governor,
And the Housing Stability Council will meet later this week to take up the recommendations. I'd be happy to answer questions you may have. There are a few materials in OLIS, including a two-page summary of the program and the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes.
Senator Olson.
Thank you very much for your testimony. The first question I have to anyone, where will the land come from?
Oh, go ahead. Chair Gelser and Senator Olson, we will invite developers, be they for-profits or nonprofits, to bring us proposals for land that they've identified in communities. We know in some communities, city government, county governments have identified land that they want to have developed into affordable housing. In other places, it's really a private sector piece. So we'll rely on them to bring us proposals, and we'll review them for viability.
Thank you. So the land basically isn't there yet. It's not state-owned land. Secondly, the next question I have for you is when this construction begins, the state will be the contractor, and if they are, will they be licensed and bonded? Will they follow all the rules of construction? Will they pay all the systems development charges and all the fees that are required?
Chair Gelser and Senator Olson, great question. We will not be the developer. We will not be the general contractor. We will not have direct business relationships with the general contractor. In the normal course of our business, we finance the construction and development of housing already with our other tools. So in some ways, this money and this program will act like that. We'll invite proposals, we'll tell the public what we're looking for, and we'll invite the private sector to bring us proposals. And we'll have a process to rate and rank those. So we'll lean on the private sector.
If you don't mind.
One more.
I'm in the industry, so I understand what you're talking about. The question I have then is, how do you reduce construction costs so that the housing can be affordable? Because therein lies the problem. If you look at your at 60% or below area medium income for an individual or for a family, one looks at that and says, well, could a normal person that's at 60% below median income be able to afford a product that you're going to have to build under the exact same rules I build under? And cost of material and cost of labor will be the same unless you find some way to reduce that. So how do you get to that point?
Senator Olson, if I could just offer an example of discussions we're having with the mayor of Oak Ridge and the city administrator. So they have a parcel of land in Oak Ridge, and they are interested in a building that could be developed with these funds. As Margaret said, we have a very deliberate process of bringing on a contractor. How we would achieve cost savings is that through the normal or the biggest program, the low-income housing tax credit program, you pay a lot for attorney's fees, council, so there's a lot of soft costs associated with developing with a tax credit, where this LIFT program, you'll be able to avoid some of those soft costs. We are seeing developers, I know in the Portland metro area, delivering units for, you know, not quite half the cost, but roughly 70% of the cost. So units for roughly 70,000-80,000. So that's our goal, is to eliminate as many soft costs as possible and deliver a cost-effective product.
The problem is you still have.
Just one more. Are you asking for another question?
Please. The problem is you still have the hard costs, which adds significantly. Soft costs are fine to get rid of the attorney's fees. You still have the hard costs, and they're still going to cost X amount of dollars to build these units. But I guess the last question I'll have, and this will be the last question, will these properties change hands? And if they do, how do you get around the ACA's requirement of a 3.5% transfer tax on real estate? Because that could be significant.
Chair Gelser and Senator Olson, I think it is possible that over the long term there would be some change in ownership. But in general, the idea is we set in place a structure that lasts at least for the duration of the outstanding bonds, 20 years or longer. In our experience, we don't see very much ownership change. As to the cost question, we're going to invite developers to tell us what they could do not to build cheaply or without durable materials and so forth. But we do know that developers are experimenting with different kinds of construction, including manufactured housing, including alternative design and construction methods. We're clear we need to have durability and good quality rental units without sacrificing quality. And we think compared to the standard affordable development models that we can achieve some cost savings. So we're hoping we'll see what the private sector brings us.
Thank you. So I wanted to go back to Danny's testimony. Apparently, the Roseburg High School government class is watching our hearing, and they were very interested in the $16 an hour to afford rent, and whether that applies statewide. Is that a particular part of the state? And where can, and this really impacts all the hearings we're having today, where can people find that study and learn more about what you need to earn to pay rent? Thanks, Roseburg High School.
This reminds, I was a former government teacher, so high school government teacher. So Chair Gelser, members of the committee, the figure came from the National Low Income Housing Coalition's Out of Reach report. They publish this every year. The figure basically looks at the standard that HUD has set for affordability that says that you live in an affordable place to live if you don't spend more than 30% of your income on rent and utilities. So 1681 is the figure that they came out with to figure out what the price would be, what you would need to afford the sort of median fair market rent. And they got the fair market rents from HUD. In the report, they give you a really just a detailed description about sort of how they arrive at that. 1681 is the statewide figure. There are, of course, differences within different counties throughout Oregon.
So Roseburg might be different from Corvallis, might be different from Portland.
That's correct. For example, Lane County, $55,000 a year. I think the fair market, the wage you would need to earn was over. It was like $1,581, I believe. But don't quote me on that. It's on the website.
Great, thank you. Any last questions for this panel before we move to the next one? Thank you all very much. And we have you scheduled for a work session next Monday, or we are scheduling you for a work session next Monday. My understanding is the amendment will be back probably Friday.
Yep.
Thank you. Next up, we have Dan Valise.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Dan Valliere, CEO of Reach Community Development.
I said Dan Valise.
Oh, it's okay. I've heard it all, so I got that. We are a nonprofit developer and manager of 2,000 affordable rental apartments in Oregon and Southwest Washington. Reach is also a member of the Oregon Opportunity Network and also the Housing Alliance. So I'm testifying today on behalf of the Oregon Opportunity Network in support of SB 1582, and also we'll note that it is supported by the Housing Alliance as well. I participated on the OHCS policy subcommittee that you heard mentioned and provided OHS staff with input and guidance on the design for this program. Affordable housing developers leverage public and private dollars to create new housing. And this is housing that will, in most cases, remain affordable for many decades. There aren't enough resources right now to meet the need that is expanding. And I will note that Lyft, this program could assist in leveraging particularly federal dollars to create more housing. So this might be federal dollars that we currently don't use. So that is part of how we also create housing. In addition to the cost reductions you heard about, we leverage more funding that functions as either grants or very low cost financing, below market rate cost financing, that allows us to subsidize and therefore make the development more affordable. Lyft will also be an opportunity to create more housing distributed across the state. That is a high priority that came out in the recommendations, especially rural communities and communities of color. It's also notable, I think, that the Department of Human Services and OHCS collaborated on this. That shows, too, I think that it's going to be a very high-impact program. So with that, I say thank you for your consideration, and we fully support moving forward with the creation of Lyft. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for?
Yes, I have one.
Great.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and you said that you have control of 2,000 units. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So when you developed those units, how did you keep them affordable and still meet all the guidelines that we, the state, put on you to build?
Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, as I said, we leverage different funding sources, mostly a combination of federal resources and also state and even local dollars that function as subsidy for the projects. Okay. So that allows us to reduce the amount we need to borrow or reduce the cost of borrowing up front. We also work to minimize the construction costs as much as possible or the land cost. So depending on the project, it may be a different variable, but those are the three ways that we make the project affordable for the long haul.
Follow up. So in the long haul, then, really to make that project affordable, you need to be subsidized every year.
Not every year, because if we do it right up front, then every year moving forward, it pays for itself with the rents that we collect. So we try to subsidize it enough up front, and that is, I think, the design with LIFT, so that we don't need an annual appropriation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? No? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 1582? Seeing none. All right, so this will be rescheduled for a public hearing and a work session next Monday, February 8th, and it is scheduled. And with that, I am going to close the information hearing on Senate Bill 1582. Next, we are opening up an information hearing on Senate Bill 1575. Do you want to read the summary while Senator Edwards is on the way down?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1575 requires the Land Conservation and Development Commission to take action that encourages increased availability and protection of land used for affordable housing, permits the commission to create a process to expedite the inclusion of land within an urban growth boundary that is dedicated to affordable housing, to protect such land from being converted to other uses, to prioritize adjacent lands for inclusion that have infrastructure capacity, and to exempt such lands from the buildable land supply requirement and from the statewide planning goal pertaining to urbanization. It also permits a local government to exempt certain land from its buildable lands inventory, requires a local government that amends its urban growth boundary to include lands dedicated to affordable housing to protect such use, permits local government to require that up to 10% of housing units in new multi-unit developments of 30 or more to be sold at not more than 30% of the local median family income for a family of four, provides for expedited land division for developments that require up to 10% housing units in new multi-unit developments of 30 or more to be set aside for affordable housing, prohibits imposition of a system development charge based on the value of improvements, facilities, or land for which the local government did not expend public funds, requires housing cost impact statements to be prepared by local governments, authorizes tax credit equal to 100% of the system development charge for construction of new multi-unit housing projects of 30 units or more, if 10% are sold as affordable housing, permits Metro to designate up to 5 subregions for consideration for urban growth boundary expansion, permits local political subdivisions to impose a construction tax capped at 50 cents per square foot as specified, requires quarterly transfer revenues to Oregon Housing and Community Services, directs that agency to distribute 50% to the collecting authority, 25% to specified department programs, and 25% to other programs after recuperating capped administrative costs, relaxes the requirement for landlords to provide secondary emergency exit routes from bedrooms, and takes effect the 91st day after sine die. There is also a Dash 1 amendment pending, which changes the sales price of affordable units that local governments may require as part of a new multi-unit development of 30 or more from no more than 30% to no more than 80% of the local median family income for a family of four. It removes the provisions that require housing impact statements, authorizes a tax credit, that is, it removes the provisions that authorize the tax credit, and removes the provisions that allow Metro to designate subregions. The Dash 1 amendment also refines the provisions directing OHCS's distribution of the construction tax revenues. And this also has a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Well done. Thank you. So we'll start with John Chandler, who's already here. Senator Edwards is on his way. He is, as we speak, testifying next door. So as soon as that is complete.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. Good bill should pass. Be glad to take any questions. Two things.
He's ever been. You
know? Yes, and I was kidding around. I'm handing out some general testimony, if you don't mind, Madam Chair, just to talk about that really quickly before we get to the substance of the bill. And this is more just for the committee's background, both today and in the future, because if you look at the backside of this, there's a chart that I put together for our national report I do to our national organization, and that's neither here nor there. Other than when I was putting it together this year, it seems particularly timely in the light of all the discussion about housing we've been having and in the media and legislature last session, this session, and probably future sessions. And it highlights the fact that what we really have in a lot of ways is a supply and demand issue. And that's not to say that supply and demand will solve this problem for us. It is to say, and I guess I'd couch it as a entreaty, that whatever it is you do, this bill, the other bills in front of you, bills that might come over from the House, whatever, don't make the problem worse. As you'll see there, we should be doing about 25,000 housing units a year. We're doing about 15. So that disconnect of 10,000 units has been going on since the recession, is a huge part of the reason behind the price increases, behind the rent increases, and it cannot be ignored. Like I say, it's not sufficient to say, let's just let this market take care of it. That's not what I'm saying at all. It is to say that some of the solutions in front of you, I believe, would exacerbate that problem of supply and demand rather than help it. So with that little bit of editorial comment, I will go on to this bill. I will mention, and your staff did an excellent job, Ms. Roth did an excellent job, there is a dash 2 amendment because the dash 1 amendment will inadvertently left out my friends at Metro, and we don't want them to miss a moment of fun this session. The dash 2 would do everything that she said the dash 1s would be, except to replace, to reinstate the language in the bill about giving Metro subregional analysis authority. That is pending, in the sense of pending, as in I discovered that the dash 1s left that out inadvertently. This bill in front of you, 1575, members, is an attempt to get at a more holistic approach to this issue. Many of you have heard from me in other hearings on the topic of inclusionary zoning that we don't necessarily oppose the idea of having the hydraulics of the real estate and development marketplace do something to help affordable housing and drive prices down. We do object to having it be a rifle shot. And in our opinion, simply lifting the preemption on inclusionary zoning is all that is. It's simply a shorthand answer that probably won't do much, either positively or negatively, but would have a huge impact on our industry as well as on the housing supply issue that I mentioned to you earlier. What we're trying to do here with 1575 is to get at a variety of moving parts on this issue, from tax policy to infrastructure finance to land use to the development industry. And Senator Edwards can walk you through what the particulars are. I can do that as well. But whether this bill goes forward in this form or not, our intention is to try to work on an affordable housing package this session that doesn't simply say no, but says yes if, works on other parts of the housing equation and tries to move the issue forward so that we can actually get serious about it. I have been having a series of good conversations with the Speaker. I think those may well result in legislation that we can not only agree to but support. This bill was our attempt to start that process. I think big chunks of this need to be in whatever final product gets passed through this body, assuming that something does. And with that, I'll turn it over to Senator Edwards with color commentary provided as needed.
Color or colorful?
Either one.
For the record, Chris Edwards, State Senator from Eugene. Sorry, Madam Chair, for being late here. I was testifying as you were notifying me, and staff was notifying me that I needed to be here. So that's how these hearings go sometimes. So the Senate Bill 1575 comes to you through a process we worked on a little bit, and I worked with the home builders and Mr. Chandler on developing this bill because we were trying to come up with a balanced approach. Last session, of course, we had the inclusionary zoning bill. Some of us in the Senate weren't comfortable with the form that it was in, and we just weren't able to get there in the final days of last session. So we spoke in the interim. I said, you know, we really need we need to come up with some solutions, and I think it needs to be a multifaceted. We need money on the table. We need some form of inclusionary zoning with some sort of sideboards that we can be comfortable with, and need to have a conversation about land use and our system of land use, because that is ultimately part of the supply issue. And I want to be really clear, because anytime you even talk about land use in the state of Oregon, people get really sensitive. And I want to make it really clear that I appreciate all the benefits of the land use system here in the state of Oregon. It protects our quality of life, and it makes sure that farmland is farmland, and forest land is forest land, and the cities are in the city, and they don't sprawl up and down the Willamette Valley and from the east side to the west side of the valley. And, you know, there are a lot of benefits for east of the mountains and the coast as well. However, the land use system, I do believe, has a soft underbelly that leaves it somewhat vulnerable, and that is, it doesn't, I don't think, adequately address the issue of cost and price. And so this bill, within the current system, attempts to, in a thoughtful and deliberative way, address that issue. That the land use piece of the bill was actually taken from a 2007 bill that was brought to the legislature by LCDC, and that was Senate Bill 1, I believe it was 187 of legislative session 2007. So we have inclusionary zoning. It lifts the preemption for multifamily units of 30 plus units to the development. Up to 10% of the units could be designated as below market. Money, it puts money on the table. It permits a local government to charge up to 50 cents a square foot on commercial, industrial, and residential building projects. 50% of that money would go to the local government for affordable housing. 25% would go to homeownership assistance, including down payment assistance programs through OHCS, and then 25% would go to rental assistance and other affordable housing programs by OHCS. And then finally, the land use piece, there are a couple pieces of this, but it directs the LCDC to write rules to encourage local governments to provide adequate supply of land within the UGB, and that the that there is adequate supply dedicated to affordable housing. It includes sub-regional analysis within the metro area. Those are a couple of the bigger land use pieces of the bill. And finally, I would like to point out that we have the Dash 1 amendments. I should have started with that. The Dash 1 amendments make a number of changes. Most notably, they eliminate sections 8, 10, 11, and 12. So if you're looking at the original bill, there was a piece on housing impact statements. That's gone in the Dash 1s. Tax credits, that's gone in the Dash 1s. And I guess those are the two biggest pieces that were eliminated in the Dash 1s. So that's a very quick overview of what the bill does. I have heard that there are other bills. Folks that have supported this approach to the land use piece of the bill have said good things about Representative Stark's bill. I believe that was brought in. That was a 2009 LCDC bill that has now been redrafted. I'm certainly open myself to this broader conversation, but I just wanted to make sure that we're having a balanced conversation about affordable housing, because it is really, really important.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Yes.
Senator Olson.
I always have questions. Mr. Chandler, I know you would be a better answer to this than Senator Edwards would be. As you well know, when we go in and develop, we run through the zoning gambit. To start with, we actually run through the can we be annexed into the city gambit, which is expensive, adds a cost. And we run through, once it's annexed in, we have the zoning problems. And we get through the zoning problems, and of course then we have the design problems with the city and how it's going to be laid out, which costs money. And then we get into the actual systems development charges. In this bill, are there exclusions or exemptions to remove the systems development charges? The reason I ask that is because I'm concerned that you want affordable housing and you turn right around and you tax 50 cents a square foot. If you build a 40,000 square foot apartment building, that's $20,000 added down on top of the system development charges, which are pretty hefty for an apartment building. So how do you mitigate those costs that we keep tacking on? I mean, we need to look in the mirror and see what we've caused. And then you add on all the building things we have to do for fire life safety, for energy efficiency, et cetera, we've added considerable cost to these things. So how do you mitigate that for the developer?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that's an excellent question. And one of the things that we've raised in prior conversation on this topic is you can't simply poof affordable housing. You can't take the end result, whether it be at the rental stage or the sales stage, and implicitly unwind all the inputs. There's a reason that housing is as expensive as it is, and this bill is an attempt to get at some of those underlying drivers. This draft in front of you, this version of the bill, isn't as precise as it should be. Our intention was to set off, in one of the conversations I've been having with other legislators on this topic, if you can require affordable housing or inclusionary zoning, you have to then offset the SDCs. That's part of the reason the excise tax is in there, is to provide a fund of money to do that. Under current law, cities can't just waive SDC charges because they have to make their SDC fund whole from other sources. City of Portland does that, but City of Portland has money to use for that. Most cities do not. So we're trying to create a system that can actually address that, taking down the impact fees, taking down the development costs, and reflecting that then in the price of the unit. The land use piece is a pilot program, is the intention. Senator Edwards mentioned the version of a land use fix that's in Representative Stark's bill. And frankly, had I been remembering the 2009 version of that failed effort instead of the 2007 version of that failed effort, it would have been in this bill to begin with. And what it will do is set up a pilot program, and I don't recall the exact particulars, to look at using the urban growth boundary expansion process as a way of increasing housing affordability. I'll be willing to bet each of you is a cookie within the bounds of the state ethics laws. It'd have to be a very inexpensive cookie. At some point during this hearing, you're going to hear the phrase tool in the toolbox with regard to inclusionary zoning or the prohibition thereof. I think that using the land use system and other systems available to us, be it impact fees or others, as tools in the toolbox is fair game as well. And our intention, to get to your point, Senator Olson, is there, you have expensive housing for a reason, both supply and inputs. How to get less expensive housing, you have to unwind that. It isn't a magic process that you can simply make the developer do it, because the developer won't be able to. And then again, that exacerbates the process. And a final point, if I might, members, and this goes to the piece I mentioned at the outset. Part of the reason we brought the prohibition on mandatory inclusionary zoning in the first place back in the 90s was our fear that local governments would use it either to make sure development didn't happen by having onerous proposals on the table that we couldn't comply with, or simply by inadvertence. And that if you have a project that's supposed to be X percent affordable and the affordable part doesn't pencil, oftentimes the entire project then doesn't pencil. So then you not only don't get the affordable units, you don't get any of the units, which if particularly now when you're in a deficit situation anyhow, is a very bad outcome. We are want to be parts of this. I think it is appropriate to use the development process and the hydraulics contained therein to try to drive this equation. This bill, as Senator Edwards mentioned, is an attempt to get at that more broad approach.
Follow up, but quickly, because we have 10 minutes and 14 people signed up.
This is for Senator Edwards. You stated that 50% of the tax would go to the local government, and I think I can quote you saying it was for affordable housing, but the bill doesn't say that.
That's in the dash one, Senator.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, that does clarify.
My question is, why don't you connect and put more money into the related programs to affordable housing?
I would say that these numbers are round numbers. Okay. 50%, 25, 25. I mean, 50% because it's half, and it recognizes the, you know, shared, you know, both responsibility and burden between the state and local government. So,
in Madam Chair, if I might, in fairness to Senator Edwards and to answer Senator Olson's question, those were my numbers in that bill, and they are there because I am a lawyer by training, and therefore cannot do math except in very large chunks like that. It's not thoughtful. It's intended to indicate some goes here, big chunk here, smaller chunks there. Whether it's 50 or 75 or 82.7, the point is to get at exactly those cause drivers using that fund.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator Lennox Anderson.
Okay. This is a thank you, Madam Chair. This is a Human Service Committee, not a land use. So this is sort of new information. I might have to talk to you offline, but I would like to know why what is the relationship between LCDC and Metro, where LCDC would let Metro know, take charge of designating five subregions for urban growth boundary. Is that for affordable housing, or is that for just expansion of the urban growth boundary at large? I'm just reading the summary of Senate Bill 1575. It says permits Metro designate up to five subregions for consideration for urban growth boundary expansion. And I was just wondering if that's overall expansion to the urban growth boundary or specifically for affordable housing.
Madam Chair, Senator Monson Anderson, it's intended to be somewhat vague by simply giving the authority to Metro to do the subregional analysis if they choose to, and what they did within that subregional analysis would be up to them as well. Currently, under the current law, Metro has to analyze the entire urban growth boundary from Gresham to Cornelius as one functional market. They may well, if this bill were to pass with that language, and they may well continue to do so, this would give them the ability to look at subregions within that, whether for affordable housing or for other uses.
Okay, so, but it isn't designated for affordable housing. That's why I say this is a land use issue. And then the other question I had, you said it permits local governments to require developers to allocate up to 10% of housing units in new multi-unit developments for affordable housing. Isn't this sort of just like inclusionary zoning?
Senator Mona Thanasson, yes. It is lifting the lid on the prohibition on mandatory inclusionary zoning to that extent, yes.
And there are other questions, but this is fine
okay.
for now.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Great. So we have about 5 more minutes on this bill, unfortunately, but we are bringing it back next week, next Monday. This is the challenge of the short sessions. We have the 4 bills to get through today. So I want to start with Randy Tucker from Metro, Aaron Doyle from the League of Oregon Cities, and Elizabeth Edwards from the City of Portland, please. And I'm going to ask you each to hit your very high level points and know that we will bring you back next week for more. And all of the record is open for everyone to access on OLIS to see your written comments as well.
Thank you, Senator Gelser, member of the committee. My name is John Williams. I'm appearing on behalf of Randy Tucker, who's in another hearing. I'm Deputy Director of Planning for Metro, and I'm here on behalf of Council President Tom Hughes and the Metro Council. We have 2 letters in the packet today. We also had prepared a presentation, but considering the time, I will let you look at that separately. We think it's very convincing, but I'll let you judge for yourself. Our main purpose in testifying today is regarding the Section 2 of the bill, which is focused on UGB expansions. It's our belief that this bill is somewhat of a bait and switch, professing to address the affordable housing crisis in our region, but actually focused on a usual plan of expanding the UGB. It's the Metro Council's position that expanding the UGB will do nothing to address the current affordable housing crisis in our region. There is a housing crisis in our region. In fact, I've just come from a summit convened by Metro with over 250 advocates from around the region addressing affordable housing. And I'm here to tell you that UGB expansions were not a tool that was, to quote John Chandler, in the toolbox of those folks. The crisis is elsewhere. In our experience, additions to the UGB take decades to work through and operationalize, and the reasons for that are many. Annexation has been raised already. The cost of infrastructure is a significant challenge. Market demand is also a significant challenge in our region. We are seeing extensive utilization by the private marketplace of properties in close-in locations, not just in Portland, but in adjacent cities as well. The tremendous amount of the housing, over 93% of housing built in our region in the last 15 years has been inside the urban growth boundaries that stood in 1979, even though the Metro Council has added over 31,000 acres to the UGB over that time. Our recent inventory, which we just concluded, found that there was vacant land sufficient for 45,000 single-family units, 40,000 multifamily units, and additional capacity for 300,000 units through redevelopment. So it's the Metro Council's position that supply of land exists, and in order to address affordable housing in our region, other tools are needed, including infrastructure, including annexation reform, including a variety of tools designed to get at the affordable housing rental market. And we believe that UGB expansions will do little, if nothing, to get at that rental market. There's just one headline I'd like to point you to that's in that presentation, which is ripped from the pages of the Houston Chronicle. Houston, like many cities around the nation, has an affordability crisis in its downtown. Houston has added about 360 square miles to its urban area just between 2000 and 2010.
That's an area about the size of the Portland metropolitan region added in just 10 years, yet they're still having an affordable housing crisis. It's related to demand for close-in locations. It's related to our economy and the jobs we need to provide. And so I just want to emphasize the Metro Council's position that the UGB leads to contentious and non-productive battles where our efforts can be better spent on closer in locations. Thanks so much for your time today.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, Erin Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I'm going to try and keep this really high level and finish up my written testimony with a lot more specifics. Depending upon the city you're in, the challenges to creating affordable houses are going to be very different. Many of our cities are looking at a land supply issue, and that is going to be a key for solving the problem for them. The concern with this particular version of it is that we're creating either amending another goal or creating a whole nother one by which we're going to have to abide by in our statewide land use planning system. And as soon as you have to open those goals back up and reexamine your comprehensive plan, you're adding years and financial burden and public process that won't necessarily help us fix the problems that exist now. Beyond that, we do have some concerns about the SDC provisions. I actually kind of liked the tax credit way or methodology that was in there. Is a novel way to address this infrastructure cost. One of the reason why cities charge these system development charges is so that we can increase capacity when new housing and new demand is built. We don't have a lot of financial tools that we can tap anymore. Originally, when we had the land use system in place and we were guns blazing in development, we were getting a lot of federal subsidy for infrastructure. We're not getting that anymore. On top of that, we've had caps on our property tax authorities that have really hindered how much more money we can get to do the capacity development. So sometimes annexation doesn't pay for itself because the value of properties coming in on the property tax rolls are not going to be sufficient to meet basic services such as police, fire, water, sewer, roads. And we're concerned that the methodology piece that is still remaining in the bill after the dash one is not the right lever, because SDCs have to be prospective and forward looking about what's the capacity need that's going to be increased. So it's hard to know what will or will not have public funds attached to it as a very more to the ground piece of the issue. I think that this is an interesting place.
Ask you to summarize.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am. This is an interesting starting point. We're willing to have the conversation, but this, as written, is not something we think that cities can afford to take on, the entire affordable housing piece. And I'll leave it to Portland to wrap up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Elizabeth Edwards, on behalf of the City of Portland, thank you so much for this opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 1575. I'll try and keep my remarks brief. Very appreciative of Senator Edwards' efforts to address this very complex issue. There's a lot in this bill. Because we're working on limited time, I will echo the comments of Metro and the League of Oregon Cities and add a few other comments that weren't addressed yet. Specifically, Section 21 of the bill permanently preempts cities from raising construction excise taxes. This is a preemption that would otherwise sunset in 2018. Once the preemption does sunset, cities have the ability to raise revenues locally for affordable housing or transportation, or not decide to impose a tax at all. In sections 19 and 20, this bill allows for a limited type of construction excise tax that is aimed at affordable housing, but unfortunately ends up exporting affordable housing dollars out of Portland right when we need them the most. So if the City of Portland were to decide under this bill to impose a construction excise tax, we would remit 100% of the tax to the state. The state takes 4% off the top. We then get half of the remaining amount. That's 48 cents on the dollar for affordable housing when we have some of the highest rent raises going on in the nation. It just doesn't pencil out, quite frankly. Real quick, I'd also touch on Section 4, the part that Senator Montesanderson referenced. Isn't this a type of inclusionary housing policy? We actually have concerns that the way that it's written, it could hinder our ability to do voluntary inclusionary housing policies, or the proverbial carrots that we've been using to implement affordable housing thus far. So there are some serious concerns there. That said, I would echo comments that we are willing to continue to work on the bill, and thank you so much.
Great. Thank you all very much. Is there anybody else that signed up? And there are many, many people signed up for 1575. Is there anyone that cannot come back next Monday? All right, so come on up, and we'll give you 60 seconds.
It takes around that long to get here.
And just because I don't like cutting people off, I'm going to set the timer. And then you'll know it's like what I tell my kids. It's not me, it's the clock.
I'll try and be quick. My name is Laurel Hines, and I live at 10371 Lake Drive in Salem, Oregon. Thank you for a quick chance to say something. I agree with the speakers who just talked that I think that this bill, my main opposition is the urban growth boundary expansion. I think that the people needing affordable housing need to be near shopping, doctors, bus lines, ability to bike, that sort of thing. Even seniors are not going to want to bus in from the urban growth boundary line. And so that's my biggest objection. I don't think this should be decided, that urban growth boundary should be decided in this committee. I think it should be in a land use committee and left to the current department that's in charge of that and be done wisely instead of tacked on to this bill. I'm all for affordable housing, but I don't think this is the way. I think the urban growth boundary part of this bill is not the way to do it. And I just think that we shouldn't exempt cities from
And then the timer is going off.
Okay. The thing is that there's no guarantee that affordable housing would be developed from this, and not it will create sprawl and traffic issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. So with that, I am going to close for today the informational hearing on Senate Bill 1575. Please continue sending all of your feedback this week. Make sure you send it to the committee so we can put that in OLIS and to Senator Edwards and myself at the same time. And next Monday, we will come back to this. So I'm closing the informational hearing on Senate Bill 1575, opening the informational hearing on Senate Bill 1533. We're already behind, so we're down to 25 minutes for this section so that we have time to get to the next one. So I have the panels from the proponents, and then we'll pull some opponents up. And again, this bill also is coming back next Monday. Senator Dembrough.
Great. Thank you, Chair Gelzer, Vice Chair Olson, and Senator Montes Anderson. I'm pleased to bring before you Senate Bill 1533. It comes from the Workforce Committee. What this bill is an updated and I would say improved version of House Bill 2564, which this committee heard last year and passed out to rules during the 2015 session. The new bill responds to many of the same set of problems that motivated the House bill last year, the need for mixed-income developments in our cities, given the growing problem of middle-income workers and their families being priced out of the communities in which they work. Whether we're talking about new teachers or police officers, social workers, or office workers, it's vital that they be able to live in the communities where they work. When workers have to commute long distances to get to work, that hurts their productivity. It's bad for their families, bad for the environment. When they work in the communities that they serve, it's good for those communities. The need for workforce housing is one of the biggest challenges faced by workers and their employers today in Portland and in places like Bend and Hood River. And that's why this bill, Senate Bill 1533, comes to you from the Workforce Committee. Elected city leaders from all over the state have been contacting me, urging me to move quickly to give them this tool that's used by cities all over the country. As you know, here in Oregon, we don't allow cities to use this tool because of a statewide preemption that was put in place some years ago. Just to remind you, the essence of workforce housing or inclusionary housing is that the city can require a certain number of units in a housing project be reserved for affordable housing in exchange for certain incentives, some of them financial, some of them logistical. City planners and developers sit down and figure out how to make the project pencil out while ensuring that new housing developments, particularly those along transit lines and close to workplaces and community amenities, are accessible to middle-class residents to promote diverse, vibrant, mixed-income neighborhoods in our cities. So Senate Bill 1533 removes the existing preemption, and it also provides examples of some of the incentives that cities must offer developers in exchange for including affordable housing in a project. Now, 1533 in its current form includes two significant changes from the previous bill. One is that it extends the focus to rentals, whereas the earlier bill was just single-family individual housing, owner-occupied housing. This is one of the focuses of this bill is on rental, multifamily rentals. And this is increasingly a significant need in this state, certainly in the city of Portland, where you have housing being developed alongside of transit lines. It's going for $2,000 a month for small apartments, actually. And that's, you know, essentially forcing people to move out into the outskirts. We're seeing housing challenges all over the state, but every city is facing unique problems, and I would say unique opportunities. So while it makes good sense for us to allow cities the tool of a workforce housing program, it does not make good sense to create a single cookie-cutter program for the entire state. You want a state policy that has sideboards on it and gives clear direction to the cities, but that allows them room to tailor their individual programs to their individual needs. And that's what Senate Bill 1533 does. And I believe that with some further amendments that we're working on, you'll see that it does even more, kind of walks that fine line between giving cities flexibility, but giving them clear direction. So we've been having ongoing discussion with developers to increase the comfort level, adding to the sideboards. You know, I will say that one of the significant changes that's in this version, as opposed to the one from last session, is that one of the incentives that's called out is state-authorized property tax exemptions or abatements. There's concern. There was concern that was missing initially, so that's been added. But we're also talking about, you know, currently the bill requires a 30% threshold for the percentage that can be required in a project. There's a sense that that's too high, so we're looking at bringing that down. We are looking at, there's a concern about, well, how about projects that are already in place? The bill has no provision for grandfathering in those projects that are in the planning stages, et cetera. That's something that would increase the comfort level. I don't think that was ever the intention. I think the assumption was that the cities would grandfather in those projects. We're looking at language that will specifically articulate that. We're looking at language to hit the right number for a floor for when inclusionary zoning would kick in, the number of units in a project. And then finally, I will say that the City of Portland is in the process of drafting a resolution that will lay out the broad parameters of how it would use this authority if it were given that authority. And I believe that once developers and the general public see that, they're going to feel a lot more confident. And, you know, as you heard from the previous topic with Mr. Chandler and Senator Edwards, lots of conversations are going on, and we're hoping that we'll have some amendments drafted this week that we'll be able to have in time for Monday Actually, I shouldn't say that we hope to. We will, because we have to.
Good plan.
Yeah. Let me just close with a quote for you from someone who testified in the Workforce Committee but couldn't be here today, Mr. Dyke Dame, who's the president of Williams Dame and Associates, one of the big developers here in Oregon, does work all up and down the West Coast. Senate Bill 1533 will result in the production of more affordable units in desirable locations, close to where people work and where their children go to school, not concentrating affordable housing on the outskirts of cities. Senate Bill 1533 will not alone solve the housing crisis, but it's a good tool for cities to create more affordable units in the years to come. Colleagues, I'm pleased to bring this bill to you. I'm happy to answer any questions. There are people who come after me who may be better able to answer some of the more technical questions you might have, but anything about the process I'd be happy to answer.
So I'm going to use my prerogative, since we're all on the fourth floor together, to urge us to have our questions with each other later. We've got about not quite 15 minutes and a lot of people signed up to get through. So. Great. Let's get as many voices out, and we'll talk more.
Then you've got another one behind it, don't you?
And then we've got another one behind it, which is why. And then there's another committee in the room, which is why we are on the schedule that we are. We were assigned a lot of bills in this committee. So next, I'm going to call up Commissioner Bill Hall, Commissioner Rod Runyon, Mayor Darby Stricker, and Director Kirk Krieger.
For multifamily.
And I know you all have a wealth of information, but I'm going to ask you to be as
concise.
That's the word I'm looking for. Thank you so much.
All righty. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Bill Hall. I am chair of the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners, the first vice president of the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm here to encourage you to support SB 1533. As I'm sure you already know, Oregon and Texas are the only states that do not allow local communities to use this mechanism for affordable housing creation. I'm now in my 12th year as a county commissioner. The longer I serve, the more I'm convinced of the truth of this maxim, that the best government and the most responsive government is the government that's closest to the people. Last year, AOC's legislative committee supported the IZ bill, and just this afternoon, we reaffirmed our support for 1533 for basically two reasons: an acknowledgement of the depth of the housing crisis and our core belief in local control. If local governments do not use this tool with wisdom and restraint, they will be held accountable. Thank you.
Wow, that was impressive.
Thank you. I used to do radio, as did Commissioner Runyon, so you learn to be brief when you have to.
We're going to hire you to give lessons to all of us.
Hello, Madam Chair and Vice Chair. I'm Mayor Stricker from the City of Talent, and I have submitted some written testimony, so I won't go into that too much, but I would like to make a couple of points. What got me up this morning and put me in a car halfway up the state is to let you know that for the City of Talent, Senate Bill 1533 is time sensitive. We are efforting to annex land into our city, both light industrial and residential, including high density residentials. That would put this type of housing right next to the work place. And for us, it's important to see this work finished in this short session. We also want to state that the City of Talent is known for our excellent planning, and to assure this committee that the City of Talent believes that we could be trusted with local control as amended in Senate Bill 1533. I want to state that the City of Talent believes that the city incentives granted within Senate Bill 1533 are the types of incentives that Talent can live with, and should we decide to utilize this important planning tool in our city, we believe we can work with it as it's written. And then finally, I want to point out that I appreciate the concerns that Senator Edwards spoke earlier, and also the representative from the LOC who said that cities small and large will be facing very, very different challenges when it comes to development. And that's why Senate Bill 1533 is so important to support, because it does allow local jurisdictions the ability to decide for ourselves what will work and what won't work. And so the City of Talent encourages the Senate to support Senate Bill 1533. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Rod Runyon, Chairman of the Wasco County Commission. Senator Gelser, Chair, I appreciate you having us here today, and Vice Chair Olson. They just drugged me in out of the hallway. But maybe it's because of the list of things I'm involved with. Besides being chair of the county commission, I'm also chairman of Mid-Columbia Housing Authority. I'm the incoming chair of Community Action in the Dalles. I've been appointed by the previous governor and the current governor to Regional Solutions and their North Central Advisory Committee, and our number one priority is housing. So doing a lot of things in that manner. Commissioner Hall and I, we're on the Veterans Committee of the Association of Oregon Counties, of which I'm co-chair of that one as well. And when it comes to veterans, housing and homelessness are a number one concern. So those are the reasons why I have a lot of hats here, from low income to attainable housing with Regional Solutions. So a wide gamut there. So I would say, in addition to lifting the ban on inclusionary zoning and enacting emergency renter protection, we urge the legislature to invest in housing development, preservation, and homelessness prevention. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Oh, we have one more. I'm sorry.
I wanted to get through the panels.
Do any questions?
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Kurt Krieger. I'm chief of Portland's Bureau of Housing. I'm here today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 1533 on behalf of the City Council and on behalf of Commissioner Dan Salzman. This is the City of Portland's top legislative priority, bar none. We have a presentation, which I will hit a couple of high spots. One thing I'd like to call your attention to is the bottom bullet here. We did a sweep of all the rental units placed into service in calendar year 2015 in the last 30 days. The average rent was $1,954. So when you hear stories about people in crisis, this underscores the fact that 80% of our market is rental, and of that, 85% is luxury housing. We're not producing nearly enough affordable workforce housing to Senator Dembrough's point. And it is becoming an economic development issue for us and for the state of Oregon. In my background, I worked in this field for Metro King County, administered inclusionary zoning ordinances for King County executives Randy Revelle and Tim Hill. I also administered programs in Northern Virginia for Fairfax County. So I've been doing this work for some 33 years, and I can say, having also represented private developers, is that this is not an unattainable goal. This is a realistic goal of asking private developers to include in their projects a portion of affordable housing units. That portion would vary depending on the location efficiency of the units. You want affordable units where jobs are located and where transit is most abundant. I would call your attention to the last bullet on this slide. We currently have a shortage of some 24,000 affordable housing units in the City of Portland. We are willing to do our fair share, and our new comprehensive plan for the year 2035 increases some 123,000 units within the city, of which 10,000 would be permanently affordable. To bridge that gap between 10,000, which we're willing to pay for, and the current 23,000, we need new additional tools. The other thing that I'd like to underscore is that we're not coming to you here empty-handed. We have deployed all of the revenue available to us by recalibrating tax increment financing from 30% to 45%. We currently, this month, have on the streets some $61.5 million for affordable housing. We're accepting proposals, and we'll be reviewing those between now and March 1st. And the City Council, by recalibrating TIF, has added $67 million to the budget. So in addition, we will securitize the short-term rental revenue that we receive from Airbnb to help offset the cost of high affordable housing costs. So we're asking you to help round out our toolbox with a land use tool, in this case, inclusionary housing. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Senator Olson, did you have a quick question?
Quick question. Do you folks on the panel, you're all government folks, do you think it's okay for the government to set prices on somebody's fair market value business?
I'd like to respond to that. I think it's fair to allow local jurisdictions to do that. I think we know our own needs, and I think we should be allowed to assess our own needs.
So it's okay to set the price for a private sector person and tell him what his lot should sell for?
I think in order for us to adequately plan our cities for our city's needs, that yes, I do think it's okay to influence the mix of affordable housing. I absolutely think so.
According to this bill, it could be a single unit house. It doesn't specify multifamily or multi-unit. This is a new housing unit that's singular. That could be a single residential house, and you're going to tell the developer or the builder that this is the price he has to sell it for?
Again, I think it is important for local governments to have the options to choose that for their own communities, and that it should not be at the state level for decision.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you all very much.
Next
panel is Sarah Zahn, Alyssa Kruger, Ms. Lathan, Diane Lynn. And then on deck, we have the one person that signed up in opposition and someone from very far away. So on deck, we've got Arthur Chappett and Wynn Baldwin. Please go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Zahn, and I'm a senior project manager for Girding Edlin Development. We're a Portland-based development company that does work in markets across the country. At Girding Edlin, I specialize in projects developed through public-private partnerships, including affordable and workforce housing. Prior to Girding Edlin, I spent 4 years as the director of Housing and Human Solutions, a nonprofit affordable housing developer active in East Multnomah County. I currently serve as the chair of the Portland Housing Advisory Commission, where I bring a private sector perspective to local housing policy. I'm here today in support of SB 1533, and I also just wanted to point out that we're really appreciative of and encouraged by the leadership of Senator Dembro on working through some key issues that are important to the development community to help make this a thoughtful and balanced bill that will be an effective tool for the development of affordable housing. As a developer, knowing the affordable housing requirements as well as the menu of economic incentives to compensate for participating in affordable housing production up front is important because it allows us to put together a project that will pencil out. Speaking specifically about the Portland market, Portland is one of, if not the lowest cost housing market to consider implementing an inclusionary housing policy. This means that implementation is critical, since higher market rents cannot offset lost net operating income on affordable units as readily as in other high-cost markets. If we do not provide incentives that will offset both short and long-term NOI resulting from an inclusionary housing policy, we could effectively affect development of for sale and for rent housing, thereby putting additional pressure on increasing prices and rents due to a shortage of supply. We don't want to inadvertently stunt growth or production, and therefore working with the development community, as we are seeing Senator Dembro and the rest of you do, is important to craft effective and balanced policies. We're supporting lifting the preemption on inclusionary zoning because when crafted properly and in cooperation with the development community, we believe inclusionary housing policies can be balanced as to not unfairly burden developers. Rather, they will address the need for both affordable and market rate housing, which is something that I believe we all agree is important for the health of our communities. Given the housing crisis in Portland, I urge you to pass this bill this session and allow us to get to work to craft an inclusionary housing policy in Portland. I appreciate that this committee is taking up this legislation, and I'd be happy to offer any expertise in the coming weeks to work through technical issues. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. I'm happy to answer any questions.
My name is Alyssa Eisenstein Kruger, and I'm a real estate broker in Portland, and I am here in support of Senate Bill 1533. I've been working with first-time home buyers since 2007, and never has the market been so dire for families of modest means to be able to purchase a home. Entry-level homes for home buyers are almost non-existent. The median family income for a family of four in 2015 in Portland was $73,900. Good rule of thumb for determining how much of a house a family can afford based on a 5% down payment and average debts is 3.5 times the annual salary, which puts that number at $258,650. In 2015, the median sales price of a home in the Portland area was $308,000. That's a $49,350 gap. Prices are still climbing at an incredibly high rate while salaries are not, so that gap is only going to grow wider. With homes as unaffordable as they are to the average family, those families that otherwise would move out of the rental market and into their own owned homes are staying put in rentals, which in turn puts more pressure on the rental market. Engaging the private market to help by creating a supply of first-time homebuyer opportunities will ease the strain on the rental market and start to build the homeowner market for the long term. Despite the huge need for more affordable home ownership opportunities, the private market so far has not stepped up on their own to help meet the demand. Without mandatory inclusionary zoning, there is little incentive for the private market to put the needs of the community over their desire for higher profit margins. These buyers who purchase affordable homes will then be able to stabilize their families, build wealth, and strengthen their own communities. Lifting the ban on inclusionary zoning won't be implemented by all communities, and all we are asking is that individual cities have this as an option in their toolbox. I have many, many colleagues in the real estate industry who see the need every single day for more options and tools for creating affordable home ownership opportunities. There are many realtors who do see inclusionary zoning as a vital option for helping create more home ownership opportunities.
Thank you so much, Commissioner Lynn.
Hi, my name is Chrysanthius Lathan, and I am here to support SB 1533. And in the interest of time, we've already discussed and heard how inclusionary zoning affects workers, but we haven't heard how it affects children, especially children of color and children with low incomes. And so that's what I would like to talk about today. I'm a new teacher mentor for Portland Public Schools, and I have 15 different teachers on my caseload. And I will say that zero out of those 15 teachers can afford to live where they work. And the issue with that is I was one of the teachers who was fortunate enough to live in the same neighborhood that I worked. And so I would see children at the store. I would see them at basketball games, weddings, funerals, all that. I would see children in the community, and they would also see me. So I understood the neighborhood. I understood the children. I understood everything about the place that I worked. Now, the problem with new teachers not being able to afford to live where they work means that they don't necessarily understand those children, especially, again, children of color, children with low incomes. And so that opens those teachers up to more bias, which contributes to the ever-growing achievement gap. What this does is continues to perpetuate the systemic racism that we know that exists. New teachers make about $36,000 a year, and we've heard all the numbers. $36,000 a year will not get you much in the way of home ownership or rental. Student loans and other bills are making that even more difficult. And if inclusionary zoning continues, then to me it sends the message that we are complicit with perpetuating systemic racism. Since we know that it's happening, we can't unknow it. So that is what I'm here for. I'm here to support Senate Bill 1533, not only for new teachers, but for children, again, especially children of color, children with low incomes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Lynn.
Good afternoon. And in the interest of time, I'll blow through this, but my job is to kind of wrap up at least our formal presentation to you today. Hello, I'm Diane Lynn, Executive Director of Proud Ground. We create permanent, affordable homeownership opportunities for working families. I'm also a former Multnomah County Chair and Commissioner and served for 14 years at the local government level. Today, I'm very proud to represent a whole range of organizations that this coalition that you don't see here today in front of you actually include. That's the Inclusionary Zoning Coalition, OPAL, Thousand Friends of Oregon, Oregon On, and Proud Ground are the leadership team. We have a broad spectrum of stakeholders from housing, land use advocates, racial, social, local governments of all kinds, and I'm going to list a few others, citizen group, senior groups, environmental justice organizations, labor organizations, environmental progressive developers, as you've heard today, and the Oregon Housing Alliance. These groups consist of tens of thousands of Oregonians across the state, including many residents that are struggling to afford their housing. Not able to testify today, but in the building or in the room are Eugene City Councilor Chris Pryor, Corvallis Mayor Biff Tabor. We have a commissioner here from Hood River that's suffering very severe impacts, Maui Meyer. State Treasurer Ted Wheeler is supporting this effort. County Chair Deborah Cafori is also here in the building testifying on this matter, and many, many more. So we really want you to know just how many people have become engaged in this issue. You've heard the problem. You know that. My written testimony provides some statistics on the impact of home ownership on children and on health outcomes and on employment. It is, we know, not the only tool. It is just hugely impactful to have the opportunity to work on it at the local level, make it right, develop it well, use best practices from the research done by Cornerstone Partnerships and many others to help us learn to do it right here. And in many jurisdictions around the country, Habitat homes and community land trust homes are not being developed in any other way except for in this environment. This will provide some release valve for communities like Gresham and the communities to the east and the west of Portland. It really gives us a great tool, and I can see you're looking to wrap up.
Yes.
And thank you for your time, and thank you for your service.
Thank you so much. And quickly, if we could have 1 minute each, Gwen Baldwin and Arthur Chappett, please.
Thanks.
And I also know you all have another inclusionary zoning hearing in 20 minutes down the hall in the House. Welcome. Thank you. And I know you've come all the way from Umpqua, and I'm going to do the same thing I did before with the 1 minute. You'll hear Law and Order go off. And there you go.
Thank you, ma'am. My name is Arthur Chappett. I'm here today representing NeighborWorks Umpqua. We're a housing developer based in Roseburg, Oregon. We operate in Douglas, Coos, and Curry counties. We know that our housing challenges in Southern Oregon are far different from what we've heard about today in the Portland metro region, but there is one overall similarity, which is that Oregon's a relatively hot market. It's a desirable place to live, and we see that continuing. We see that demand growing over time. Metro was estimated that there'll be an additional 750,000 residents in the metro area by 2035. And there are similar growth patterns occurring in the rest of Oregon. Growth is good, and we look forward to it. More importantly, it's inevitable, though. It can't really be stopped. And we see this inclusionary zoning tool as an important way of offsetting the worst effects of gentrification without preventing positive redevelopment. So we support the Senate bill, and I look forward to seeing your decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Excellent timing.
Thank you.
There you go.
Jeez. Sounds like a ringtone.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Gwen Baldwin, and I represent Multifamily Northwest. So this is going to be a different perspective from the one you've heard to date. And I think the thing that we have a shared goal around is a balanced, healthy housing market. It's good to have more housing at all levels of affordability. That's what makes the best options, the healthiest communities, the most livable neighborhoods. And so we support that goal. The challenge is, how do you do it? And unfortunately, Senate Bill 1533 also allows partial rent control, which is a significant issue for us. It partially lifts the preemption on rent control. And the challenge is, when you freeze rents for some people, those costs transfer to other renters, making that less affordable. So somebody's workforce housing suddenly becomes more expensive. Wow, I'm not sure what to do with that tune.
My children.
So if you look at San Francisco, and San Francisco has both a sort of a blanket rent control, but also that sort of rent control related to required development. In the 23 years that they've had that, they've done about 1,700 some odd units of affordable housing. You look at Portland, and in just two neighborhoods, in half that time, they did over 2,200 units of affordable housing. And how did they do it? Because they had a program that was volunteer, where you brought people together, it worked, it penciled out, and it worked really well. And in fact, that multi-program has just been revamped to become even more streamlined and more user-friendly. And we just had a brown bag earlier, I guess last week, and 26 members from our organization came to learn more about it. That never happened because it was just considered too onerous to work with. So, you know, they have the old adage, you get more flies with honey than vinegar. And there is a way to do this that creates that kind of voluntary activity that will build more units at all levels of affordability, and that's what we all want. We do not support lifting the preemption on rent control.
Thank you very much. And thank you, everybody. Again, I apologize for the speediness of 2 hours to get through four bills. But this bill will be back next Monday. So again, please continue communicating. Please continue in the hearing at 3 o'clock down the hall in the House Human Services and Housing Committee. So with that, I'm closing the information.
Madam Chair, just before you do, I just want to say for the record, I don't think this bill really lifts the preemption on rent control. It does allow rents to be kept below market with respect to the other markets, but it's not freezing rents. Anyway, I'd be happy to talk. I'm eager to talk with you.
It is a partial lift, and we will have that conversation. Great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. And with that, I'm closing the informational hearing on Senate Bill 1533 and opening up the informational hearing on Senate Bill 1548. And I would invite Dave Honeycutt, Sean Jillians, and Ted Ferrioli when he gets in the room.
I want Ferrioli sworn.
Oh, absolutely.
We can just swear at him, okay?
Yeah. So we're going to go ahead and have Cheyenne summarize the bill for us while we're waiting for folks to come up to the...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1548 allows local governments to modify urban growth boundaries to include land dedicated to needed housing if certain determinations are made and subject to approval of the affected city and landowners by unanimous consent. Prioritizes land that is adjacent with infrastructure capacity and sized to meet projected demand, requires such land to remain dedicated to needed housing for 10 years following inclusion within an urban growth boundary, declares an emergency, is effective on passage.
Thank you. Welcome. Thanks for your patience.
Chair.
Off to the races.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I was actually going to defer my time today, Madam Chair, since I can come back on Monday and touch on all four bills that you all are considering. The one thing I would just say now, I'm delighted to hear that this committee is at least entertaining land use as part of the discussion. Feel that Senator Edwards' bill, this bill, Senator Dembrough's bill, all could be incorporated into something that we ultimately could support.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action here in support of Senate Bill 1548. This, again, as Mr. Jillians indicated, we get some land use into the housing discussion, and land use is important simply because we have such a critical shortage of land available for development in the Portland metropolitan area. In order to build affordable housing, you have to have affordable land, and in order to have affordable land, one of the ways that you do that is to increase the supply. Currently, within the boundary, I know there's been some discussions in the previous bills that there's land available for development inside the urban growth boundary, and one of the things that they point to is Damascus. Damascus, as those of you know, who is one of those places where there are no services available. It's land that was brought into the boundary because of the focus in 197-298 on where to expand the boundary. But the current the boundary expansion language results in Damascus coming in, but Damascus has no capacity to serve, to build affordable housing. There's no services out there. And so in order to make land available within the boundary, you might want to expand the boundary into areas where the services are readily available so that you can get water and sewer to it quickly and at an affordable cost in order to keep the prices low so that you might actually be able to make a project pencil out. Because if the project doesn't pencil out, you can tell folks, you can tell my members, you've got to build it. But if the project won't pencil out, we're not going to build it. It's we're in business, you know, we have to make some money, and we can't do that if we can't get land and services.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, just Mr. Honeycutt, it isn't just Portland. UGB is a cumbersome and unwielding process everywhere.
Absolutely, yeah. And one thing that I should note, 1548 applies not just to the Portland, not just to Metro's urban growth boundary, it applies statewide.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Senator Ferrioli. I've learned while texting you that your name autocorrects to fertility in my iPhone.
Okay.
I'm careful to give thought. I don't need both these microphones.
Don't tell his wife, okay?
Madam Chair, I appreciate, my name is Ted Ferrioli, or Senator Fertility, if you insist.
Did you swear him in?
Oh, I have not been sworn, Mr. Vice Chair.
I believe we should.
Are you serious?
No. Save it for the real thing.
No.
Okay.
I have never seen the procedure, Madam Chair. I would love to see the procedures. So.
We can practice it now if you want, but they're going to take this room from us in less than 12 minutes.
You know, Madam Chair, I can finish my testimony in half that time.
All right.
Shall I proceed with my testimony, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. The bottom line for me is that supply and demand is the key equation here. You've seen what supply and demand has done for the price of gasoline. I mean, I was ecstatic. I came over the mountains and paid under $2 for a gallon of gasoline. If you look around, there's a bunch of reasons for that, but mainly it's that we're producing more domestically. If I could just pull that example and overlay it on the housing issue, I would suggest we got a supply and demand problem. And I was able to listen part of the interim here to your hearing, Madam Chair, and I want to commend the folks who are arguing for affordable housing. Their compassion is clear, their objectives I agree with. I absolutely understand how people struggle with affordability for housing. If I could just remind the members of the committee that in much of my district, the per capita income is half what it is in the urban area. And so if housing affordability is a concern in the Portland metro area with some of the highest wages that our state offers, think of what it's like in communities where we have double-digit unemployment and job opportunities are very scarce. Affordability is an issue. When I talk to local jurisdictions about, you know, what's the problem here? How come we don't have more affordability in our housing stock? The answer is they are constrained by the urban growth boundary, a 3 to 4 year planning process, and a 5 to 7 year litigation process. So I will tell you that I believe that the desire to protect high-value farmland is a virtue. I will also tell you that people who live in the rural areas have no desire to see their environment spoiled, and they need to be able to have solutions to critical problems like affordability of housing. So what we tried to do with Senate Bill 1548 is to take into consideration the issues of supply and demand and the constraints that people have in smaller jurisdictions to figure out how are they going to add to the stock of housing, all kinds. Certainly people, as better housing comes online, vacate, you know, it's a stair step. They vacate the lower income housing and move up in the housing stock when that's available. The bill before you would allow local government to expand the urban growth boundary as needed for housing if the vacancy rates for the previous calendar year were at 6% or lower. Now, you know, I don't know what the vacancy rate in Bend is or in Portland, but from what I understand from listening to your testimony, it's brutal. It's a tough market out there. They need to have more housing. Certainly that's true in the rural areas as well. The expansion, because there's a limitation on where it could be, it's for housing, and it's at a certain level of vacancy rate. The expansion would only occur where there's a need for it, where there's a demonstrable, documentable need for more housing. And a localized approach, I think, is the best one to ensure that the outcomes are what that community wants, but also that don't do violence to the whole concept of land use planning. No other use would be permitted under Senate Bill 1548. It's specific to affordable housing. It's specific to need. So I guess, Madam Chair, what I would do is to commend the bill to you for consideration because it really does work on that whole supply and demand issue. Mandates sometimes have their place. You know, discard the idea out of hand. But every time we've tried a centralized government planning system for housing, using mandates, we've created a continuing disaster in those communities. Housing projects, we don't even talk about them anymore because they have such a negative connotation. What's really necessary is that you improve the whole panoply of housing stock in order to allow people to bump up to the next level of housing. You know, we can talk about some of the other issues like employment and the need for job creation, but this bill is very specifically targeted on creating more of the housing stock for low income without a mandate, by being permissive, by working in cooperation with the local government, and to making sure that the outcome only could be achieved if there was a needs assessment done by the local community. To me, Madam Chair, it seems like it offers one of the easiest and best solutions to deal with the affordability question that we have before us. It doesn't require builders to re-pencil or, you know, doesn't completely overturn our whole concept of land uses. Madam Chair, with that, I will happy to entertain any questions that the committee may have about the bill.
Thank you. Any quick questions before we release the room to the next
I do have
committee?
One quick question. Yes. That is, Senator Farrielli, thank you. We heard from somebody testifying earlier about the dangers of having low-income people sent out to the fringes of the urban growth boundary, as she put it. You know, because often they're people who are very limited in terms of their mobility, you know, one bus line is really not going to be good enough. I mean, you know, we'd like to see people, you know, where they can more easily access community services, et cetera, et cetera. And those do tend to be more limited out in the areas that would be opened up on the outskirts of the urban growth boundary. So I wonder how you would respond to that.
Madam Chair, if I may, I will decline to answer the question on the grounds that it might tend to incriminate. No. I listened very carefully to the chair's introduction. Others may also want to respond to this, but in two-thirds of the state of Oregon, the access to mass transit is not what it's like in the metro area. And pushing people to the fringe may only be two blocks. You know, it isn't exactly like they're all the way across town from the core of the communities. So I think the real solution to these problems is local solutions. Every community has its own vision of itself. Almost every community will freely admit to having an affordability problem and a serviceability problem. One of our problems in the frontier is that the housing stock that's out there that's affordable is not standard housing. It's substandard housing needing rehabilitation. But to try to get somebody to come in there and do the remodeling and rehabilitation, the rents won't justify the expenditure. What would be far better for us would be new housing stock in a variety of different categories so that you get people who can make the change to more serviceable housing able to make that change, and that actually makes more housing available for everybody across the spectrum. So I'll defer to my colleagues.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Denver, I'm actually happy that you asked that question because I felt like I should have hit on it a little bit in my limited testimony. I think there are a couple of things that Senator Farrielli mentioned. First of all, when we look at this issue, we have to stop looking at it through our old lens of what affordable housing is. We're not talking about 30% of AMI anymore. We're not even talking about 60% AMI. We're talking about 80 to 100 to even 120% of area median income, and people can't afford housing at that level. So when you're looking at people at 80% or 100% of AMI, they have a vehicle. They have a job that they're already driving their vehicle to, and so being a little bit on the, quote, outskirts is not that detrimental to them, especially if they're in an integrated community that has some affordable units, some market-rate units, and a nice housing mix. The other thing that we've discussed is it's not all the Portland region and way out there. The city of Woodburn went through a very lengthy and costly process. It took them almost 20 years to expand their urban growth boundary. When they finally did, the new boundary expansion, which is just being finalized via mediation, that actually, you could walk to every amenity imaginable within 10 minutes from there. The new housing that's coming in on the west side of the freeway, you literally could hit everything walking if you didn't have a vehicle. So I think we sort of look at it in the Portland paradigm of its way out there. In these small communities, it's literally right across the street from existing services.
And with that, we are going to have to adjourn. We're at 3 minutes till the hour, and there's another committee coming into this room. So
thank you,
we will be back and discuss this more. Thank you so much. We're closing the information hearing on Senate Bill 1548. And as you can see, our time is really pounding closely. So on Wednesday, let's try to be here right at 1. And we're adjourned.
I only asked
one. And we're adjourned.